Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the USA Hockey conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Mr. Dave Fisher. Mr. Fisher, you may begin.
Mimi, thanks very much, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us today. As we kick off the celebration of Hockey Weekend across America presented by Reebok, which officially begins on Friday and runs through Sunday. And I think, as you know, we put the framework around this. USA Hockey began in 2008 to join the hockey family together over the course of the weekend to celebrate our great game and those involved at all levels, and also to help expose our sport to new audiences. We put a theme to each of the days. Friday, wear your favorite hockey jersey. Saturday, bring a friend to the rink. And Sunday, celebrate local hockey heroes. And it's been fun to see the engagement of our hockey community across the country in this celebration now in its third year. And with the Olympics a little more than 2 weeks away, we thought it was appropriate this year to conduct a series of media teleconferences as part of Hockey Weekend across America, centering around the theme Golden Moments in our three gold medal winning ice hockey teams. And today the focus is on the 1960 U.S. Olympic men's ice hockey team celebrates its 50th anniversary of winning the first ever gold medal in ice hockey for the United States in 2010. And we're thrilled to have three of the members of that historic team with us here today. Before we get to the players with us on the call, however, I'd first like to introduce for some opening remarks the Executive Director of USA Hockey, Mr. Dave Ogren. Dave?
Fish, thanks very much, and thank you, everybody, for participating in the call today. You know, our 1960 team has been, I think, for a long time, the architects of an under-recognized achievement. The media was in a different state and time in 1960, but the fact of the matter is the odds were just as long, the achievement was just as great, and they were the only ones who can say we did it first, the first United States team to ever win a gold medal in the Olympic hockey competition. We have had a real good time in the recent months in a variety of celebrations involving this team. We're very proud to have them as part of the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame induction night in Boston back on the 1st of December. The team, of course, was installed some years ago. But it was great on the occasion of the 50th anniversary, which only happens once, to get some of them together again. Bill Cleary, who you'll hear from shortly, was with us that night. And we just had a great time, and I think it's so appropriate on the 50th anniversary of that special achievement that we have another games. It's in North America, it's a great and I think much deserved occasion to put a spotlight on that fabulous accomplishment from 1960 one more time. There's a DVD that was produced and distributed as of about 30 days ago. Some of you know about it. Scott Burnside, who I think is on the call, just popped me an email a short time ago. It's called Forgotten Miracle. It is something which we licensed. We do not own, but it's a wonderful product, a documentary about the 1960 team. It is available through our website, usahockey.com. And some of you have asked about it. It's just a terrific piece, and I think it just reflects and honors these individuals so very, very well. I think they are the ones that you want to hear from, so I'm going to, without any further ado, Fish, turn it back to you and just say thanks to everybody who's on the call from the media. I suspect some of you have perhaps never written about this 1960 team and its accomplishment, and I hope you will, because they're endlessly deserving of attention and praise, because they are the pioneers that showed us the first time how to do it.
Thanks very much, Dave, and we will hear from each of our three players on the call from that team, and then take your questions. First up, Bill Cleary from Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Bill, of course, played in the 1956 Olympic Winter Games for Team USA, won a silver medal and, of course, a gold in 1960. He was the leading scorer on the 1960 team and later went on to be an ultra-successful college hockey coach at Harvard University, won the national championship in 1989, and also served as athletic director there into the 1990s, and a great pleasure to have with us today, Bill Cleary. Bill?
Thank you, Dave, and nice to be here, and it's nice to be around and still being able to celebrate what we did, but it's hard to believe that 50 years has gone by, and Scott, I haven't seen the forgotten marrow because my grandkids have taken it and I haven't got it back yet. And but everyone who's had it has really raved about it. I just came from a beanpot luncheon and they got up and started talking about it. Jerry York was talking about it at the luncheon. So it's got some great reviews so far, and I'm sure it will continue. Hard to believe that that time has gone by, and, you know, I think in reflection, we did have something to do, I think, with the growth of hockey, with our victory. I'm not sure we were aware of it at the time, but certainly I look at it in the Boston area, you know, our interest did cause a great stir in hockey at that time. Certainly not like the 80 team. I said the difference between our two teams is our pictures were in black and white and theirs were in color. And so I think, but we did create a stir in the growth of hockey here. And right after we won that, Bobby Orr came in and the Bruins started playing well. And I think it really, I think we had a start. We gave it the impetus, I think, to the great growth of hockey that we've got in the East here. So, and it's hard to remember everything because all I know is that no one gave us much of a chance. And I think all the magazines were picking us to finish 12th and only 8 in the final grouping. And then when we started playing and we beat Canada, then of course the Russian game and climax with the Czech game, it really created a stir. And but it took great performances, certainly from Jack McCartan, who's on the phone, and all the rest of the team to beat those teams. And and I can say with good pride, and I know Dick can do it too, that we played in 2 Olympic games and we never lost to the Canadians. And I like that. So I won't forget that either. So,
thanks, Billy. We like that too. Hopefully every team can say that, right?
I hope we can do it up in Vancouver this year too.
Well, thanks very much, Bill. And you mentioned Jack McCartan, and we'll call on Jack next, of course, from St. Paul, and he played at the University of Minnesota and seemingly stopped every shot thrown at him at the 1960 Olympic Winter Games. Jack was the goalie of record in all 7 games, a perfect 7-0-0, 2.47 goals against average, and we are very pleased to have the goaltender of record of the 1960 Olympic team with us, Jack McCartan. Jack?
Thanks, Dave. You know, seems like every 4 years when the Olympics come up, people call and they ask you about the 1960s, and probably there's a lot of stock answers that go out. You know, you beat the Canadians, you got momentum and things like that, but recently I've been thinking, you know, that's the same old response and everything, and I got to thinking a little deeper, and I thought, you know what, we really had some good hockey players on that team. I mean, we had 16 guys, 17 guys. We had 11 forwards, 3 lines on a spare that was interchangeable, 4 defensemen played all the time, and 2 goalies. And when you look back at some of the achievements of some of the guys we had, like our Cleary line had Bob and Bill, and then Bob McVay. I mean, you're talking about 3 of the better hockey players that came out of the East probably for all time. And we had Paulie Johnson, Weldy Olson, Dick Meredith, and Gene Grazia. And all of those guys, they all had good history of being great hockey players. And then we had the 2 Christian brothers, Billy and Roger, along with Tommy Williams, and that was a great line for us. So along with Jack Crane, our captain, was a rock on defense, and John Mayasich, who I'll put up against any hockey player ever lived in the U.S. I might be a little prejudiced, but that's the way I feel about him, and Bob Owen and Rob Pavla, a couple of young guys. And so I think now that I look back on it, I think, you know what, we probably shouldn't have been underrated because we really had good hockey players. As far as our impact on hockey, I think we had some impact, but you got to realize that the only game televised at that time was the Russian game, and the Canadian game or the gold medal game wasn't televised, and I don't think they were even planning on televising the whole Russian game, but things got looking pretty good and exciting, so they kept it up. But I guess my most recent memory is the type of players we had.
All right. Thanks very much, Jack. Appreciate it. And Dave Ogren mentioned Forgotten Miracle. You can go to ForgottenMiracle.com as well. I have had the chance to see that piece, and it is just terrific. And I think those of you on the phone that have not seen it, and obviously you're all ingrained in hockey, you will certainly enjoy that. Dick Meredith also with us. I guess I was asking the guys before. Bill Clary checks in at the right page of 75. Jack's the youthful one at 74. And now we go to our senior citizen, if you will. No offense, Dick, at 77, the one with all the wisdom. Of course, Billy mentioned he played on the 1956 U.S. Olympic men's ice hockey team as well, won the silver medal and went on to play in 60 and win the gold from Minneapolis, and attended the University of Minnesota as well. And we could not be more pleased than to have Dick Meredith on the phone with us today. Dick, please go ahead.
Thanks, Dave. I guess recollecting about 1960, I think probably the biggest thing to me was beating the Russians. Now, if you look back, I played in 56 in Cortina, and the Russians took it to us. And in 58 in the World Championships in Oslo, they took it to us. And 59, we're back to Prague, and they took it to us. And then we came to the U.S., and we're playing in Madison Square Garden and through the rest of the country, and they were taking it to us. Finally, we get to Squaw Valley, and the law of averages got in our favor, and I think they got a little overconfident. But to get whacked so many times, it was a good feeling to finally defeat the Soviet Union. Most people didn't have an idea of just how great a machine they were. They were basically a professional team, and to see them play was just a pleasure. And they played like true champions, and when you beat them, you knew you really had done something. We had beaten the Canadians before, and we were very proud of it, but we always knew what to expect from the Canadians. It was always a rough tumble game, and they were a little on the cocky side, and we surprised them too. But to look back and reflect on the games itself, it's like a good baseball pitcher. We had a good goaltender, and that made us a contender with everybody. And you can look back, and both Canada and Russia, you win by one goal. We really wouldn't want to go back and play them over another time, but it was our time, and it happened in Squaw Valley, and we're very proud to have won the championship flight, and we won all our games. I don't think this has been done by any other team. So at the end, we picked up our medals and 7 days of work and won 5 games, and the next day went back home, and we all went back to our jobs, and it was a good time. And here we are today, 50 years later, thinking, geez, that was a wonderful time. Thanks.
And Dick, maybe before we turn it over to Mimi, you were just in Squaw Valley, you were telling me, a couple weekends ago. Maybe you can just touch on that.
The Squaw Valley had a 50-year celebration, and they had a 50-year centennial, and they invited members of the ice hockey team and also other Olympians playing in Squaw Valley in 1960. It really was a great time. They treated us well. Basically, it's a ski town. The arena is gone. The facilities are all gone. You wouldn't know it except for the valley. But they were very appreciative of us. Myself and Paul Johnson and Weldy Olson were there, and they couldn't do enough for us. Of course, in Squaw Valley in 1960, the only gold medal winners, I believe, were the two figure skaters and ourselves. So we were really a big deal to them, and they really treated us well.
Thank you very much, Dick. And with that, Mimi, we'll bring you back in and take us through the question and answer portion of today's call.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star 1 key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Again, if you have a question, please press star, then 1 on your touchtone telephone. Our first question comes from John McGarty of NHL. Your line is open.
Thank you very much, and congratulations to all you guys. Bill, I wanted to ask you, I can think of some names here. Dick Toomey, who won a state championship in Massachusetts 6 years after you guys and went on to coach Brown. Larry Plow, who was a great player in the late 60s in Massachusetts and went on to be GM of St. Louis. Robbie Fatorica, coach Cap Raiders with Tampa. These are guys who watched you, I know because I've talked to them, and went on to careers in hockey that you inspired. I was wondering if you could tell me about conversations you've had with younger players that you know that, and also if Dick and Jack could weigh in on maybe a Doug Woog or somebody like that from their part of the country.
Yeah, I can remember well Robbie Fatorik. In fact, his mother and father had seats to the Bruins game right behind ours, and I was with her the night that Robbie was born. And, you know, they followed hockey. And, of course, when we did come back from winning the Olympics, that was a big thing to them. And I remember Robbie talking to us all the time and trying to go skating with him. And I think it did have some effect. As I say, I'm not sure it didn't have the publicity that the 80 team won, or if you're doing it now, because it just wasn't that way. I mean, I think, Jack, you said we were the only the Russian game was on TV. But I think once we did win, I think certainly I saw it around here. I think it did affect young people. I think more people got involved with hockey and went on to play. And then, as I said, Bobby Orr came right after that. So I think the combination of the 60 and the advent of Orr certainly spurred the game of hockey in the Boston and East area.
Thanks.
Jack?
Well, you know, right after the Olympics, I played pro hockey for 14 years, and I was gone a lot during hockey seasons around here, so I really never had anybody really come up and talk to me about it except recently, and I was unexpectedly was Lefty Curran, who was the goaltender on the silver team in Sapporo, and we played together with the Minnesota Fighting Saints in that WHA. And all of a sudden we talk maybe once every couple of weeks, and we talk at length and about a lot of things. And he told me that I was kind of an inspiration to him, and that it really surprised me in a way, because I've known Lefty for 20, 30 years, and this talk has just come up recently. That's about the only occasion I've had.
Dick?
Well, I'm thinking after, you know, in 7 days we played five games and we win the gold medal, and then we go home by commercial plane. Now, the Western fellows went to Minneapolis, and, of course, the Eastern guys went out to Boston that way. And I always remember getting on the commercial plane. There was about four or five of us, and we had all of our gear on, our traveling gear. And the captain came on and congratulated us, and the whole cabin, everybody rose and clapped, and I thought that was pretty special. But, you know, it wasn't – we went home. We weren't going to the White House and being introduced or anything like that. We were going home to the Minneapolis airport, and when you land, the local writers were there, and they interviewed you a little bit, and I would say within a week's time it all passed away, and here we are 50 years later. Thank you.
Thank you.
But you know what? They're still talking about us 50 years later.
Right here.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Brian O'Connor of Boston Globe. Your line is open.
Thanks, gentlemen. Congratulations. It's a real pleasure to be on the call. For Jack and Dick, I had a chance to watch the documentary. I thought it was really, really well done. My question really has to do with the fact of Billy and Bobby Cleary coming on to the team late. You know, of course, the story's been well written about the fact that Herb Brooks was one of the last players cut, so that symmetry, I think, is fascinating. But if you could talk to me and the other listeners about just that dynamic of bringing both these young men in from the East, and how it might have upset the apple cart at first, but somehow, you clearly put it all together.
Dick, why don't we start with you?
Thanks. Well, I'll put it this way. The Clarys were a great addition, as was John Masich. Earlier in our exhibition series, we did hear about that the Clarys wanted to come as a twosome, and our coach was basically saying, well, we were only going to ask Bill. And so he kept telling us this, and then when we got to Denver, we really didn't know that this was all transpiring until we saw him in the lobby. But to say that Herb Brooks was cut because of Bobby isn't fair, because there was about three other players that were cut at the same time. So you can mix or match either way you want to. But I really, really truly believe, probably not at the time, but I really truly believe now that he made the right decision.
Jack?
Well, Bill, you probably don't know this, but I probably pushed Riley over the edge in North Dakota with an 8-day tie when we had to pull the goaltender to tie the game. So I probably pushed him over the edge that night anyway. I don't think it would have been, if Bill and Bob would have been there from the beginning at the tryouts, I don't think there would have been any, I know there wouldn't have been any problem. I mean, they were two of our better players in 59 when I played. But just the fact that I guess that some of your buddies had to go, it was a little awkward for maybe a couple of days, and then we just got into the rhythm of things. Things were fine.
You know, from my point of view, I understand completely, you know, the fact that the players on the team, you know, could resent us coming in or any of the fellows that would come in late because, after all, they were working hard for how many months before that. And really, I really had no intention of going, and Jackie called me several times, and then finally we did go, my brother and myself. But I can understand fully why the fellas felt the way they did. But I think, as Jack said, once we started playing, I think, and that's the beauty of sport, once you get into competition, you're out there for one goal, and that's to succeed, and you forget all your petty likes and dislikes, and that's what we did, which was a tribute to all the fellas on the team, I think.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Scott Burnside, or ESPN. Your line is open.
Thank you. I've already bored Jack with my questions, but if Dick and Bill could tell me, what did you do when you went home? What did you return to? What were your jobs? And I have a follow-up question after that, if that's all right.
Bill?
I can remember, Dick, you said you came home to Minneapolis Airport. I remember there was Dick Rodenheiser, myself, my brother, and Jack Corrine, and we got off the plane Chicago. We took the red eye home right after the final ceremonies. And I can remember picking up the paper and saying, Russian helps American win gold medal. It talked about Sologubov offering us the oxygen. And we got a big kick out of that. But on the way home, we kept saying, geez, I wonder if anyone will be there at the airport to see us. I think anyone will know we won. And surprisingly, each community, Brookline, where Jack was a fireman, and Dick Rodenheiser was from Malden and Cambridge, all had people there to be there, and we had fire engines going through the city. And so we were surprised that even that many people knew about it. But it was fun, but we just went right back. And one of the reasons I couldn't go, I had just started a job. And don't forget, we didn't get paid like they probably do now to play. And I was getting married in May of that year, and so I just couldn't afford to take that much time off. And that's basically why we didn't go, and we went right back to the jobs.
But what did you do, Bill?
I just started in the insurance business.
Okay.
And so, you know, I was a neophyte in that business, and it's a tough business to get started in. So, but I went right back and went in the office the following week, and it was like work as usual.
Well, what did you do, Dick?
Well, I I got back home and I started looking for a job. Our general manager, Jim Claypool, was with First Bank, and so I got into the banking field, and I lasted there about 7 years before I got in with the Minnesota North Stars in the NHL hockey. But, yeah, Bill was talking about getting paid. We made $7 a week, and you couldn't sustain that for very long. Things were getting a little tight, and I was living at home, and I could get by there, but we were grossly underpaid.
But I'll tell you, we wouldn't trade one day of it, I'll tell you.
Great. Well, thank you both, and thanks again, Jack, for your time earlier.
Yep.
Thank you. Our next question comes from John Powers of the Boston Globe. Your line is open.
Yes, hi, thanks. This is for Jack. Jack, I think not a lot of people seem to remember that you were actually cut for time before the games and brought back. How did that work, and what did you do in between the times?
Well, actually, I was in the Army,
mm-hmm.
and they put you on TDY to try out for the team, and the tryouts on our part were in Minneapolis. So I just, instead of taking barracks with the Army, I stayed at home, which was fine with them. And I think it was around the 1st of December when he made the cut, and I went home and I thought, well, there's no sense in going back. I was at Fort Carson, Colorado. No sense in going back. I'll just take a 30-day leave and stay home for Christmas, and I'll go back. And I was it was right a couple days after Christmas that I got a call from Jim Claypool asking if I'd like to come back, and there was not much of an option there. It was either go back to the Olympic team or go back to the Army. So I chose the Olympic team, made a wise decision, and so I joined them out in West Point sometime before the New Year.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Chris Bay from California Rubber. Your line is open.
Thanks. Gentlemen, it's an honor to speak with you. And I wanted to ask you a couple of questions specific to California. Did the idea of playing hockey in California, and Olympic hockey at that, seem strange to you at the time?
Who wants to take that one, guys?
I'll take it. I'd really say not at all. We didn't think anything of it. Just prior to the Olympics, we had two games with the Czechs down in L.A., and that was very fine, and then on up to Squaw Valley. But really, if you look at Squaw Valley, well, Squaw Valley, California, you look there, it's basically a ski town. And they had taken in and built nice facilities, very nice for a ski village. The rink was excellent, and all the facilities there, including the rec hall and all the buildings for the athletes. And it was just a great time with everything in walking distance. But I don't think anything of us thought of anything contrary, that it was just a nice place to be.
That was Dick Meredith, by the way, for those of you that didn't know. Bill Cleary, anything to add on that?
I don't think we ever gave any thought about Squaw Valley because it was a winter recreation ski area, and obviously that's where you're going to go to compete in the winter games. And the fact also, which I think some people forget, and that's why I'm getting a big kick out of it now when the National League is playing all these outdoor games, I think there was a rule in the Olympics at that time that you had to play outdoors. Dick, you remember Cortina. I mean, that was just a crescent-shaped, three-decked edifice. It was just magnificent. It was completely outdoors. And so was Squaw Valley. One side was completely open. So, you know, we didn't think of it in those terms because we thought of it, you play outdoors in the winter games.
Jack?
Well, it was the first Olympics and the only one I ever been to, but when I went there, it was an Olympic atmosphere for sure. I mean, the ski hills and the hockey rink and everything, so I thought it was great.
And incidentally, I think they did a terrific job, which I think is sometimes missed now. I don't think they could do it because the Olympic Games, Dave, you might correct me on this, but I think they're much bigger than when we played in Squaw Valley. And the number of Olympians that you had compete, but we all had to live in the village, every competitor. And it was wonderful because we got to know all the players from all the teams. which I think is an important part of the Olympics, and I'm just sorry to see that disappear.
You know, Billy, this is Dave Ogren. In point of fact, our teams continue to stay in the village and always have.
Good. I hope they do, Dave, because I don't, you know, from what I read, and even the summer games, they don't do that.
That's right.
Yeah, no, that's right. And our players, they want to stay in the village, much to your point. I mean, that's a big part of the experience.
It is.
Chris, did you have something else there? Or is that what you need?
One other question for Jack. I know that much of your pro career was spent in California, and is that something that you would have imagined at that time? And maybe any highlights for you from that?
Well, I didn't know what to expect when I got into it. I got into it at, with the Rangers, and, of course, at that time there were six teams in the league, and each team had one goalie, and there wasn't much room for myself, you know, skill-wise. So when I did get out to the West Coast, I played a couple of years in L.A. I was up in San Francisco for a couple, and then I spent 4 years in San Diego. And it was called the old Western Hockey League, and it was on a par with, say, the American League out east. But the travel was better. You traveled by airplane. The buildings, the rinks were better. You stayed in better hotels. It was an upgrade in that regard from the American Hockey League. And I really enjoyed it, especially my time in San Diego. The weather was great, and we drew well. I think we averaged over 9,000 people a game out there. They had Max McNabb had a real thing going out there in San Diego, and I really enjoyed that.
Jack, how different was it going to Williams Arena to play in 0-degree temperature, or going to play out there in 85-degree?
Well, you know what, Billy? Yeah. You know what? You get inside the building and the boards and the glass and everything is all the same. So once you get in there, it's hockey.
It is.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then one on your touchtone telephone. Our next question comes from Jay Nanda of San Antonio Express. Your line is open.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's been a pleasure listening to all your accounts and your stories of your experiences. I just have a general question for whoever wants to take it, and that is, if and when you have an opportunity to talk to members of this year's team heading up to Vancouver, either the players or the coaching staff, what kind of message or words of advice would you convey upon them?
Who wants to take that one, guys?
Well, Bill, you went through that, didn't you, Herbie?
With Herbie?
Well, yeah. Didn't he ask you to talk to the team?
Oh, yeah. Actually, Herbie did do that. You know, ever since when Herbie was cut at that time, as it was mentioned previous today, Herbie and I coached against each other when he was at the University of Minnesota, and I think we were really good friends for all these years. And the only time I went back to the Olympics was in the 80 games, and somehow someone got some tickets to go to the Russian game, and so I went up there, and I said, gee, I want to just go down and wish Herbie some good luck before the game. And I went down, and they were just coming in from the warm-ups, and I saw a lot of the kids that I tried to recruit and wasn't successful at, and had a good chat with Herbie. So I said, Herb, good luck, and I started walking out. And the trainer for that team, maybe you remember him, Jack. I can't remember his name.
Buddy Kessel?
No, it was
Gary Smith.
Gary Smith?
No, Gary Smith.
That name isn't familiar. But anyways, I was going out, and all of a sudden the trainer came by and said, hey, Herbie wants you to go back and talk to them. I said, what? And then Herbie's like waving me back, and he said, I want you to go in and talk to them. I said, oh, my God, what the heck am I going to say to them, you know? But I remember going in there, and I said to them, I said, you know, I think I know exactly what you're going through right now. You're isolated in this small little hamlet up in New York State, oblivious to what's going on in the rest of the world because, you know, you're just imbued with the Olympics and playing all the games. And I said, but let me tell you, you have captured the emotions and spirit of not only this country, but throughout the world. Everyone is looking at you. And I'll tell you, there's no doubt in anyone's mind that you guys are going to win this. And I'll tell you, the 17 guys that have cheering louder for you are the 17 that played on that Olympic team in 1960, and they know you're going to win it. And I walked out. But that, Herbie did ask me to do that.
Jack, what would you tell this year's team if you had a chance to speak to them?
You know what? These guys, they're different than we were, Dave, in the respect that they're pros. And most of these guys have been involved in NHL playoffs, NHL Stanley Cups. And, you know, they've been through a lot of things, and maybe this is another one that would equal in memory or intensity of those things. But at the same time, they've had other things that they can equate to, whereas when we went, the Olympics were the thing that you look forward to when you were in college, to play in the Olympics. And after that, that was about it for most of us. So what you could say was, you know, I respect you guys for what you've done, and but this is a little different venue, and I'm sure that you're going to be just as involved in this as you would be in a Stanley Cup playoff game or the Stanley Cup finals. And just enjoy it and do your best, because some of your best memories will come from it.
Dick, no bigger stage than the Olympics for hockey. What kind of message would you have to the players and staff?
Well, much what Jack just said, I would echo the same way. It's a little different stage now, and we're talking almost a different game. And like anything, you've got to put out your best when the best is needed, and I'm sure that that's going to be the template for this Olympics. So the only thing I could say is just give your best. And my opinion, or what I've done and seen, is probably not as in the same level as those gentlemen that are going to be playing the game. And I think they're well aware right now that they're going to be on the stage, and they're going to want to show the best that they have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Brian O'Connor of Boston Globe. Your line is open.
Gentlemen, a follow-up question that I was reminded of due to a couple of comments from Jack and Dick. There has been a lot made of the fact that there are pros playing now, and I've heard a number of arguments on both sides as to whether they should continue. Clearly, the players want to be there. You played, obviously, at a different time. Could I get your thoughts on that topic?
Who wants to start on this one, guys?
Oh, I will. I think it would be hard to go back to amateurs now from watching the best in the world professional-wise to play. I actually think it would be hard to go back. Plus the fact that a lot of these kids, and when we played, the guys who played in the Olympic teams were drafted into the Army after college, and then they look forward to playing on U.S. teams. And these guys are probably, some of them have spent maybe 1 year, 2 years in college, maybe no college, maybe they spent a couple of years in junior hockey, and they're 20 years old, and they're going right into the pros. So it's a little different story, and a little different perspective.
That was Jack McCartan. Let's go over to Bill Cleary. Bill?
You know, obviously, I think a lot of people know where I stand. I'm not a proponent of the pros playing in the Olympics. Never have and never will be. And, you know, I think there are choices in life that people have to make. And, hey, I had a chance to play pro hockey back when I was a sophomore or freshman in college. I didn't. And it's probably the best thing I ever did, because if I hadn't, I wouldn't have played in two Olympic Games. And I don't see, I still would love to see kids have an opportunity to play. And it rubs me the wrong way to see pros playing in the Olympics.
And thanks. Dick?
Yeah, I take a look back at it, and I'm not all fired up for the pros playing in it, but the fact of it is that when we were playing, how we got to this point is because the pros were playing. We're playing the Russians, and the Russians were paid, and they were sportsmen for the Soviet Union. That's all they did is played hockey, and if you didn't perform, you had a lesser job. But so that got us into putting the pros back there. But the other thing is that we haven't been very successful playing with the pros. If you look at it, we've got two gold medals, and they were done by some basically college kids. So you got to look at it at a lot of different angles, but hopefully they can straighten it out. But the thing was that the Europeans were basically professionals, and here in the U.S. we were basically college kids, and that's where it all started.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then one on your touchtone telephone. I'm showing no further questions at this time.
Well, Mimi, thanks very much, ladies and gentlemen. Tomorrow at 2:30, we'll have members of the 1998 gold medal winning women's ice hockey team with us. That's tomorrow at 2:30, the same number you dialed today. We'll work for that. And then Friday, we'll finish the series with our 1980 men's team at 2 o'clock Eastern on Friday. Again, the same number. We'll get you into that call. Our great thanks to Dick Meredith, Bill Clary, and Jack McCartan today for participating in this wonderful exercise. And again, if you have not seen Forgotten Miracles, certainly urge you to do that. Any questions you have immediately, feel free to call me here in the office, 719-538-1171. Thanks again, and have a terrific day.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes the conference for today. You may all disconnect and have a wonderful day.